Good evening, genties and ladlemen of the Audio Radiance, and welcome to Spider on the Web number 30. Tonight I got a whole bunch of thank yous and props and shout-outs to do, so first thing I want to do is thank all of you who have dropped a few bucks in the donation hat the last couple of weeks. I truly appreciate it. This is a user-supported podcast, and your help goes a long way. Thank you. Next, I want to thank my good friend Jen Stark. Herr Jen Stark lives near Hamburg in Germany, and he is the cat who originally turned me on to the whole concept of BitTorrenting and walked me through it until I could do it myself. Furthermore, he not only introduced me to BitTorrenting, but he introduced me to the wonderful site dimeadozen.org, where you can download your music not only free, but guilt-free, because you know that you're not taking a dime out of the pants of any musician, and you know that if any of those musicians had any objection to that material being downloadable, they could just say so and it would be removed instantly. Anyhow, I owe Jens a hell of a lot. I would venture to say he's actually doubled the size of my lifetime music collection just in the last year. So I owe him plenty, and in consequence, whenever he recommends something to me, I listen very closely, and so far we haven't had a loser yet. Well, he just finally worked up the nerve to try on me, a guy from Hamburg named Stefan Gvildis. I'd never heard of Stefan Gvildis before, maybe you haven't either. All I can tell you is this cat has got as much soul as anybody singing in English. This is the exact kind of stuff that the Beatles probably heard playing on the Reeperbahn back in the day when they were there, because this guy sounds as soulful as anybody I can think of working in North America today, white or black. Now, I'm hampered a little bit here by my own linguistic ignorance. I wandered around Amazon.com. I found that they have two CDs and one DVD for sale by Stefan Gvildis. I have no idea what's available on Amazon.de, and I can't tell if what I got here matches any of the stuff on Amazon.com. I simply can't translate the titles. So with some diffidence, I'm going to reach into what appears to be a bootleg DVD of a live concert and pull out a representative track and hope that it ain't copyright and ain't for sale in North America and or anywhere else this podcast reaches. And especially, I hope that Stefan Gvildis will not get pissed off at me for bringing his music to the attention of North America. And I certainly hope he won't get pissed off at Jen Stark, who loves him dearly. But for Jens and for Herr Gvildis, here now is a little track off of a live concert DVD that should give you an idea of what the man can do. As you'll notice, he doesn't just translate the lyrics into German. He does a little transposition, too. Here now is his version, Stefan Gvildis' version of Tanzen über Kies. Regrettably, I'm going to have to join the track in progress. I don't dare play you the whole thing because I don't have permission to podcast Gvildis, and I just don't speak German well enough to be positive this DVD is a bootleg. It would be horribly ironic if I ended up getting me, and for that matter, Jens, in trouble because he was trying to turn me on to somebody he really loved. So here, then, is an excerpt from, if not the entire track, of Tanzen über Kies. Kies, by the way, I'm informed by Jens, is basically another word for the Reeperbahn, or it's known in other towns, the Red Light District. Tanzen über Kies.
Wir wollen raus in unsere Welt, denn nur da gibt's den neuesten Beat. Die Nacht ist da und die Zeit ist reif, oh, wir tanzen über den Kies, wir tanzen auf der Straße.
Das Herz in der großen Freiheit. Auf dem Spielbodenplatz. Und am Millertor.
Oh, well, I don't know about you, but that got my blood pumping. I'm very sorry, John, Paul, George, Pete, and Stu, but that beat the pants off of Sie lieb dich or Komm gib mir deine Hand or any of the Beatles recordings available in German. That's the real deal. All right, now for some reading. This week I'm going to read you one of the editorial columns I published in the Globe and Mail, Canada's national newspaper, over a given period of time, whose exact parameters escape me at the moment. This is a first of a pair of matched columns that ran over several weeks about the humans of Sol 3. Join me now as we beam down to a strange new planet. Our 5-minute mission? To determine whether intelligent life exists here. And since we have only 5 minutes, there is no time for a proper study of the large-scale organization or behavior of the planet's dominant species. We must simply drop in, take one quick technology sample at random, assume it is representative, and draw the best conclusions we can. Ready? Cue the special effects! God, that always tickles. Okay, we're in a typical dwelling of this race. Humans, they're called. We've tried to bias the test in their favor as much as possible by choosing our sample from one of the most affluent regions of the planet. Surely here will be found their most intelligent technology. Tricorders ready? Let's look around. The room we're presently in, the name sounds like a sneeze, is the one in which humans store and prepare their food. The largest two items in the room are a heat-making machine and a heat-losing machine. They sit side by side, yet careful sensor readings indicate they are not connected in any way. Let's look closer. The heat loser is, bafflingly, designed to stand on its end, so that you must spill money on the floor every time you open it to access or even inspect its contents. And they put the coldest part on top. The heat maker is complementarily designed to spill money on the ceiling. Not just the four heating elements on top, one of which is always defective, this central module, called an oven, has a door which inexplicably opens from the top, so that you cannot touch the contents during cooking, even momentarily, without wasting all the heat. The whole unit is utterly unprogrammable, and lacks even the simplest temperature readouts. Everything is done by guess. Perhaps some sort of cultural blind spot is at work here. Let's examine the water recycling facilities. There are none. Humans throw potable water away. They throw hot water away. And look at the temperature control system. There is none. No sensors, no thermocouples, taps completely uncalibrated, though all those technologies are trivially cheap here. They keep a large, almost uninsulated tank of hot water heated at all times to skin-scalding temperature, using none of the waste heat to warm the pipe so that hot water would always be slow in arriving when needed, and then mix it with cold water to a safe temperature by hand, adjusting the result by testing it with their own skin, with every use. Well, perhaps humans customarily eat in restaurants, and this room is only intended as a fallback, in case, let us say, a wave of psychosis passes through the restaurant industry and they all start turning away a quarter of their customers rather than turn on a fan. Let's try another room. And let's make it as fundamental and essential a room as we can. you need not necessarily sleep in its bedroom, nor relax in its living room, nor work in its study. But there is one room in which every human must spend some time at least once or twice a day. Surely there, if anywhere, we will find the most thoughtful applications of intelligence. The first and largest thing we find there is a combination shower and bath. It cannot be used comfortably to bathe and cannot be used safely to shower. Its principal purpose appears to be to kill the elderly, unfit, and unlucky, which it does with ruthless efficiency. The shower head is usually fixed, impossible to train on the areas where it is most needed. It has worse temperature control than the sink in the other room and is tested with the entire body. No provision is made for hair accumulation in the drain or, usually, for venting of steam or gradual equalization of ambient temperature after a shower. Well, let's move on to the central fixture, the commode. It enforces an unnatural, inefficient, and uncomfortable posture, presents about the most uncomfortable sitting surface possible, has absolutely no facilities for either cleansing or disinfecting either the user or itself, and, after use, it takes the precious, irreplaceable fertilizer and throws it away, using gallons of potable water to do so with no attempt at recycling. The obvious one-way valve to prevent it backing up is not present, and for a full 25% of its purported purpose, as a male urinal, it is completely and manifestly worthless, a constant source of domestic strife. But if you think that's odd, keep going. There is a perfect, rationally designed male urinal right here in this room, less than a meter away. But for some reason, no male human will ever admit to having used it for that purpose. This would somehow desecrate it, soil it. Officially, it is reserved for saliva, nasal mucus, toothpaste spit up, beard hairs, blood, assorted skin paints worn by females, and the truly disgusting things humans seem to have to rinse off their hands all the time. Needless to say, it too must have its water temperature laboriously reset by guess with each use. Above it on the wall hangs another curious thing, a cabinet designed to spill its contents. The spice rack in the last room, meant to hold items of uniform size and shape, has retaining walls for them. But these shelves, intended to hold items of varied size and shape, do not. And they are always too small and shallow to hold what is required. The overflow goes under the sink where it can grow mold faster. Well, now let's go back to the commode. Does it come with a reading lamp? No. Not even a magazine rack. Good God, Spock, are these creatures savages? There are stereo speakers built in, surely. Power and data feeds for a laptop? At least tell me there's a built-in deodorizer. Oh, let's stop. It's time to beam back up. These hominids may have developed some clever technology, but they are obviously not bright enough to have given the slightest thought to applying it to their own most basic personal comfort, and so they cannot possibly be regarded as sentient. We'll check back in another century or so. It's possible humans are going through some sort of temporary cyclical madness. Every adolescent species has its crazy years. I suppose I should have mentioned beforehand that the title of my column originally was The Crazy Years. And this was based on the basic prediction, which you'll find in Robert Heinlein's Future History Chart, that this era of history would be one which he described as, quote, one in which a man with his gaskets tight would have been locked up. Robert felt that a combination of converging technologies and other factors were going to drive the human race slug-nutty along about the turn of the century, and lo and behold, the Admiral called it again. Hence I had named my column The Crazy Years, though it later came to be known as Past Imperfect, Future Tense. A name for which I thank astronomer Jamie Matthews. That's enough reading for now. Let's have a little bit more music. And this is another shout-out to an old friend, Bill Stevenson from Halifax. One of the first times I ever saw Amos Garrett perform in a club setting was in a place called the Middle Deck in Halifax, and the house band there was run by Bill Stevenson. Included incredible players like Fastlane Francis and on saxophone and Tim Cahoon on drums and the incredible Skip Beckwith on bass. Bill was at that time running a CBC show called Ocean Limited, which showcased some of the very finest music you ever heard, and almost none of it is now available from CBC. I'm sorry to say. However, somebody got on the stick and recorded some of Bill's music and put it out. I just learned that a CD exists called For the Record by Bill Stevenson with Tom Easley and friends. I'm going to give you a little bit of Bill's voice and piano and General Stone on a couple of tracks from For the Record.
jump and jive, keep alive, tell all your trouble goodbye. Go on and have your fun, have a ball when the work is done. Play with your baby, keep real fine, tell all your trouble goodbye. Lovely night, everything is really alright. Go out and party from fire to fire, tell all your trouble goodbye.
Bill Stevenson on piano and vocals, Tom Easley on bass, Dave James on drums, Russ Brannon did that smoking guitar, and if I'm reading this right, sax was by Evan Shaw, excuse me. The CD itself, by the way, is available at http://cdbaby.com/cd/BillStevenson. That's BillStevenson. One more time. cdbaby.com/cd/BillStevenson. All one word. I don't usually give anybody two in a row, but there's a Percy Mayfield song I've had in my mind a lot lately, for reasons that I expect will be tolerably obvious when you hear it. And Bill happens to have a really, really sweet version of it on For the Record. So here then, one more time, Bill Stevenson and Tom Easley, For the Record, with Percy Mayfield's The Danger Zone.
Sad and lonely all the time. That's because I've got a worried mind. The world is in an uproar. The danger zone is everywhere. Might see just exactly what's been bothering me. world is in an uproar. The danger zone is everywhere. You know my love for the world is like always. Because the world is a part of me. That's why I'm so afraid of the progress we have made towards eternity. Read your paper and you might see just exactly what's been bothering me. The world is in an uproar. The danger zone is everywhere. Because the world is a part of me. That's why I'm so afraid of the progress we have made towards eternity. Read your paper and you might see just exactly what's been bothering me. The world is in an uproar. The danger zone is everywhere.
Bartender, swivel a beer on that piano player for me, will you? Thank you. All right, a few weeks after the column I read you a little while ago was printed, I thought about it some more and produced another one called Humans Reconsidered. 2. Kames T. Jerk, Commander, Starship Exit Prize. From Academician Ipul University of Aldebaran. Subject: your report on Sol 3. Dear Captain, I don't think you're being entirely fair to the humans of Sol 3. I've read your recent assessment of their intelligence, as exemplified by the personal comfort technology found in their fuel intake and exhaust chambers, and I cannot fault your data. But I think you've missed a subtle point which colors your conclusion. There is about humans a quality so profoundly strange that it renders questions of intelligence or stupidity simply irrelevant. I have spent some time in that sector of the Lesser Magellanic Cloud, not by choice, of course, a breakdown, and ask you to believe that this is true, however improbable it may seem. Humans believe at their core that life is not tough enough. A primary example. Like any sentient species, they recognize the need to transmit information non-verbally with high reliability over distance. Like most, they developed a symbol system. In their case, dark stains on leaves of whitened plant matter. An unstable medium, but then their lives are short. They called theirs an alphabet. So far, so good. But humans believe life is not hard enough. They could not stop there. The most advanced tribe of them developed not two, but three alphabets, almost but not quite identical, called uppercase, lowercase, and script, for absolutely no reason at all. These humans require their young to master all three, and an endless series of self-contradictory rules for when each may slash must be used. The largest tribe of humans, on the other hand, uses an alphabet that has endured essentially unchanged for millennia, which contains hundreds of characters of surpassing complexity and is nearly impossible for most humans, even of that tribe, to learn, write, type, or translate. Consider language itself. The purpose of language is to encode reality and communicate useful observations regarding it. Obviously, the more languages you construct, the more ways you have of looking at reality. Integrate enough of them, and the noise should filter out, leaving a refined approximation. Humans have a reassuring plethora of languages, and much urgent reason to want to communicate with one another. But almost no human learns more than one language. Bitter, emotional debates often rage on whether it should be permissible for the young to be schooled in as many as two. This requires that every message between different tribes be laboriously translated by a single freak expert whose work cannot practically be checked. Attempts at establishing a planetary pigeon, the very first sign of a civilization, have been made, but never seriously. Yet humans maintain a planetary civilization. They do not believe life is hard enough. The human ecosystem teems with substances containing neurochemicals which induce pleasure in them. Nearly all humans show clear need for at least some such pleasure above that provided by simple, successful survival. Most of these chemicals have some societally damaging side effects, some great, some small. Dealing with those would be a large but entirely manageable problem. But humans don't think life is tough enough. Their response is usually to absolutely forbid any use of such a substance, punishing violators with death, torture, imprisonment, and disgrace. I swear. Accepted, of course, are substances that do not make a human feel good enough to arouse anyone else's envy, e.g. sugar, chocolate, caffeine. But the only other exception, and one made almost universally around the planet, is for the single substance which demonstrably and unmistakably has the most destructive effects, ethanol. All substances in between tend to be demonized in direct proportion to their relative harmlessness and the strength of the user's need for them. This clearly does not work. It produces a daily spectacle of slaughter, waste, corruption, and degradation which has continued for several centuries. They simply do not see it. They acquire a blank look when you point it out. Humans reproduce sexually and at high efficiency. At present, they are confined to a single planet, for no explicable reason, apparently by choice, and thus suffer a small overpopulation problem, so intense it must be immediately apparent to the meanest intelligence among them. They are extremely blessed by nature in that A, contraception itself is trivially simple for them, and B, there are a number of alternative sexual recreations that offer no possibility of impregnation and are even more pleasurable than the procreative act itself. So, what do humans do? They deify ignorance. They do their level best, knowing in advance that they cannot possibly succeed, to ensure that their young will learn nothing about sex, not even simple hygiene, for as long as possible. Indeed, sexual ignorance in children is given the special name innocence, and considered not only a virtue, but the ultimate virtue, You Mins deliberately go to enormous trouble to guarantee that their own young will begin their sex lives incompetently with maximum possible emotional trauma, just as they are most fertile. Recently, You Mins developed technology which makes unintended conception a correctable mistake, long, long before a developing fetus could possibly possess a single functioning nerve cell or pain receptor. And so, now, inevitably, the most revered and popular religious leader in the history of their planet tells them all such technology is evil. He himself is a celibate. Life is nowhere near tough enough for the inhabitants of Sol 3. You Mins made, I think, a terrible historical mistake. They destroyed or tamed every single predator that threatened them, from saber-tooth to smallpox, and gained control over most natural catastrophes, long before they were emotionally prepared to do without them. They have become too accustomed to the regular sound of ringing alarm bells in their heads, and so will manufacture emergency if none arises naturally. In between emergencies, they fantasize about them. They are addicted to fear, and for some reason cannot admit it. They are neurologically wired up to deal with a more hostile environment than presently presents itself, and are undone by the lack of competition. They turn their own intelligence to making life difficult enough for their own comfort, for their own innate sense of the rightness of things. Thus, the brighter they are, the stupider they appear to be. It is what makes them happy. We can judge it only as art. And they are clearly great artists, currently shaping their greatest collaborative creation yet together, a masterpiece known as the Crazy Years. All right, I'm going to do three tracks in a row now by the same guy, partly because he's just that good, and partly because I don't have permission to podcast his music for you, and so I'm going to have to fade his track out well before it ends, to be on the safe side legally. This is, amazingly, another Jen Stark turn-on, for which I am terribly grateful, Dankeschön, Jen, despite the fact that David Quayle was born in Sacramento, California. Mr. Quayle, apparently, if I've got the story right, and I don't see why I should, left his home one day carrying a nylon string guitar and set out walking, looking for a place where they would pay him a living wage to play such an instrument as a nylon string guitar. Thank God he found one before he starved to death, and when he looked around, he was in a place called Germany, where he has lived for many years. Now, this first track is one of his best known. It's an original composition called Santa Cruz. And then I'm going to follow it with a little bit of another one called Ride of the Headless Horseman. And then finally I'll close out with a composition by a couple of songwriters whose names I forget. Thank you. Well, there you go. That's from a lovely CD with the title, some of whose letters are bold-faced, so that it comes out, Unbeatable Songs. And if you read the word Beatles there, that's up to you. It's one of many wonderful David Quayle CDs, and you can find out about most of them at www.davidquayle.com. Parts of which I'm happy to say are in English, and the parts that aren't, I'm sure Google's translation facility can help you with. It did me. Check it out. Also, you can see David Quayle play some of that stuff, including Santa Cruz, on YouTube if you hunt around. And once again, a big thank you to Jens for the mighty turn-on. Okay, here now is our third and last Crazy Years column this week. I'd like to point out that they are collected in a volume cleverly titled The Crazy Years, Reflections of a Science Fiction Original, published by Ben Bella Books and sold at better bookstores everywhere. In fact, it's pretty much the definition. This column is called And Now the News. And by the way, as I read this, I ask you to visualize the blood draining from the head of my editor as he pictures himself printing these following words. In the early 50s, the great SF writer Theodore Sturgeon wrote to his friend Robert Heinlein that he was both broke and blocked. He literally could not think of a story to save his life. Robert's reply was typical of him. A check and several pages of story ideas. All of them made money for Ted, but one in particular inspired a very prescient and powerful story. Heinlein had said, "Write about the neurosis that derives from wallowing daily in the troubles of several billion strangers you can't help." From this seed, Sturgeon created And Now the News, available in several collections and anthologies. His protagonist is a simple, good man with an obsessive addiction to the news. He takes every paper sold, subscribes to current affairs magazines, keeps news on the radio and TV at all times. Whenever asked why, he quotes John Donne, "Every man's death diminishes me, for I am part of mankind." Over time, his obsession deepens. He makes a desperate attempt to go cold turkey, and events ensue so astonishing, I honestly don't think it'll spoil the story for you if I give away one of the kickers here. In the end, the guy tells his shrink he's finally found a viable solution to his problem. He's going to go out there and diminish mankind right back. The last line is, "He got 12 people before they cut him down." This was 40 years before the Unabomber. If Earth is one big starship, the news media constitute its intercom, and almost nothing comes over the intercom but damage reports. Tragedies way over on the other side of the vessel, malfunctions in inaccessible compartments, tales of distant madness and mutiny, conflicting rumors of collision hazards in our path, and constant reminders that first, our acceleration is increasing beyond all design expectations, and second, that there is no captain and the wheel is being fought over by vicious ignoramuses. Is it any wonder morale is so rotten on this starship? Pessimism has become the very hallmark of sophistication. Only a dullard would go to see a movie known to have a happy ending these days. Every Hollywood sci-fi future is either a nightmare or dismissed as a fairy tale. We, the richest and luckiest humans who ever got to gripe for 70 or 80 or 90 or 100 years, are coming to subconsciously expect and in some perverse way to crave the imminent end of all things. And so we find ourselves obsessed with damage reports, like a man staring in fascination at the slow progression of gangrene up his leg. No rational person can blame the media for this. We demand it of them. We won't pay for good news. We insist on knowing the worst, even when we're helpless to do anything about it. God knows why. Attempts have been made to establish cheerful media, which would scour the planet to tell you everything that went right today. Every averted tragedy, miraculous serendipity, or realized dream that might give you hope, lighten your load, and they all went belly up. There is no media conspiracy to depress people, but there is a media conspiracy to feed ourselves and our families, and that means we must sell you what you want to buy. I don't propose that the media lie, or suppress facts, or strain for Panglossian slants. But if we're going to convey the truth and nothing but the truth, we ought to shoot for the whole truth. Every news outlet needs a regular feature given equal weight with today's lead story titled Silver Lining. The massive resources of the news gathering industry could, and should, as both public and self-service, manage to come up with one story a day that made us feel a little less like diminishing mankind right back. And it wouldn't hurt to quadruple the comic section while we're at it. I've experienced 5 decades, nearly 6 now. With all its plagues, wars, disasters, and injustices, the one just passed, in which computers got friendly, the Berlin Wall came down, the Soviet Union peacefully folded its cards, nuclear apocalypse receded for the first time in my life, smallpox was annihilated, Mr. Mandela walked free, perfect music reproduction became trivially cheap, Geraldo Rivera's nose was broken on camera, and the Beatles put out 2 new singles, has been hands down the best. Yet it was back in 1965-75, a decade when just about everything that could possibly go wrong did, that a significant fraction of us last seemed to believe we could change the world. Hope, belief, and the possibility of beneficial change is a scarce and precious resource and has been throughout history. Every society that ever ran out of it died. Our hope is battered daily by the barrage of bad news and by the defeatist attitude it engenders, the cynical compulsion to deconstruct every comforting myth, to find, or, if necessary, invent feet of clay for every hero, to explain away every hopeful event as a cursing in disguise. Granted, we can't hide our heads in the sand. It is my obligation as a crewman of Starship Earth to listen to the intercom regularly. But it's also my obligation to turn the goddamn thing off when it starts to impair my morale. That means triaging my newspaper, removing CNN and News World from my remote menu, and zapping the network news fungus whenever it appears. You'd be surprised how little you miss that way. After a dogged, relentless effort to ignore the O.J. Simpson story, I find I still know far more about it than the jury was allowed to. It's possible to have too much information to do your job. Fear is a subtle and potent drug, and it has its uses. Daily news is civilized man's analog for the exhilaration of facing the saber-tooth, a daily hit of bracing fear. But dosage is crucial. At high concentrations, particularly if mainlined, taken by television, evil side effects start to set in. You cannot kill this saber-tooth. There is nothing one can do about any of the horrors in the news, purely local bun fights excepted, except fret. And at some point, panic, yield despair. And when there are enough panicked, despairing people on the starship, the crazy years come. Time we all turn to the funny pages. It's important to remember something else Robert Heinlein once said. The last thing to come out of Pandora's box was hope. Well, that's a good note to leave on. But I hope you'll forgive me if I take this occasion to briefly point out before I go that in April, Blackstone Audiobooks will finally begin releasing the Stardance trilogy in audiobook form. They'll release my reading of Stardance in April, Starseed in May, and Starmind in June. One last sincere thanks to all of you who have contributed or subscribed. I really appreciate it, and I'm out of here. As always, this episode of Spider in the Web is being podcast under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. Now, why don't we both go and see if we can make somebody else grin?